Before we begin today's episode, I want to thank everyone out there who's a longtime listener, and also everyone out there who is not a longtime listener. Just thank you so much for being a listener. And I'd also like to take this opportunity to point you toward patreon.com/deepinbearcountry, where you, yes you, can become an official citizen of Bear Country by simply contributing to this piece of work, art, I don't know what you want to call it, but you can become a patron of my podcast, Deep in Bear Country. Now, how do you do that? Well, you can join at one of three levels. There's the $1 level, which is called Cub, where you will have access to any and all bonus episodes I decide to record for this show. At the Bear Scout or $5 level, you will get a chance to submit a speculative Bear Country question that I will address at the end of an episode. And at the $10 or Great Natural Bear level, you'll get bonus episodes, you'll get to submit the Bear Country question each month, and you'll be able to recommend an alternate children's book series for me to devote a bonus episode to. That's right. If you've ever wanted to hear me cover, I don't know, Little Critter or Curious George or Caillou or anything like that, then just become a $10 patron, and I will do whatever you tell me to do as far as children's books go. If you really want to hear me talk about another book series for an hour, that's the opportunity to tell me what to do. So I am not trying to pressure anyone into giving. If you can, that'd be great. If you can't, that is also great. But just know that while no money is required, all money is appreciated. I really appreciate the fact that people are even listening to this show, and I'd love to continue to be able to do it on the reg. So go to patreon.com/deepinbearcountry and consider giving a little bit. All right, now on with the show. Welcome back to Deep in Bear Country, a Berenstain Bearcast. I'm your host, Phil Gonzalez, and this week we are going back to Pennsylvania for a visit with Mike Berenstain. This is part three of our visit with Mike Berenstain. Now, if you remember in the last episode, we had finished talking with Mike in his studio, and he said that he had some stories to share with us, but that they were only going to be able to be cleared up by going down into the archives, where he could show us some of the work. So that's what we're picking up today. We are talking with Mike, we're visiting the archives, and again, this is an audio show, so I am not able to illustrate it with what we were actually seeing down there. I'm going to put some pictures up at berenstainbearcast.wordpress.com under this heading for this episode, and you can check out a few pictures there and sort of see what Brad and Jeremy and I were going through as Mike was telling all of these stories. So get ready for stories, oohs and ahs, a few more anecdotes about the publishing industry, and a good look inside the world of just how Berenstain Bears everything is put together. I hope you enjoy part three of our visit with Mike. See you at the end.
Was it crazy to grow up loving Dr. Seuss books, knowing that your parents had like worked with Dr. Seuss?
Well, the thing is, the sequence was different. It was the other way around.
Because of the time.
Yeah. I mean, these books are from the 50s, 40s, and 50s. Yeah. And so these were big things when I was growing up. And so I got these books as a little kid and read them, and my brother did too. My brother was reading, this was one of his favorite books in nursery school, McElligot's Pool. Mm-hmm. This is from the late 40s. And so that was actually connected to their involvement with him because they knew them from their kids being fans and reading them to us and us reading them and being very involved with Dr. Seuss as kid consumers. And then when Cerf and Geisel, when The Cat in the Hat was published, I got that book like for my sixth birthday. That was when it was published, 57, I was 6 years old. Oh, yeah. And I got like five copies from different people.
because
it was so famous and it had just come out.
Oh, yeah.
The new Dr. Seuss book. And so they were very aware, and that was what led to beginner books. Mm-hmm. That was such a phenomenon that Cerf and Geisel got together and said, "Well, we're going to start this whole publishing operation." And so Phyllis was going to be partnering it. And do you know Phyllis Cerf was? You know who Ginger Rogers was, the actress?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Phyllis Cerf was her younger sister.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Little known piece of bizarre trivia.
Wait. Okay.
Phyllis Cerf was Ginger Rogers' younger sister.
Okay.
And that's how Cerf met her, because he was hanging around with actresses and showgirls and chasing.
Okay. It's all connected.
Yeah.
It's all connected.
Bennett was one of those kind of guys. He's yeah. like the old movies where there's a guy with flowers hanging yeah. out by the stage door. That's who Ben Cerf yeah. was. Uh-huh. And Klopfer, Donald Klopfer, was his partner. He was the serious guy. He was the guy who didn't do that.
Yeah.
I got to meet Klopfer later, which was fun. But anyway. So they start Beginner Books, and my parents being, you know, Geisel was a cartoonist, and that's his background, and they had thought about, in fact, I shouldn't do this, but let me show you something. They had started to talk about doing kids' books early on, even before this. This is later work that was done on. But they tried to get a book published called The Littlest Window.
Oh.
It was a kid's book. And I don't know where it is. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I always show it to you. But it had nothing to do with bears. It was a fairy tale. Just a pure fairy tale, kind of fractured fairy tale. And they took it to their cartoon publisher, Macmillan, and they said, well, we don't publish this kind of book. This is cartoons. You know, we do serious children's books. But they wanted to do, like, a cartoony kid's book. And when they read in, I don't know, Publishers Weekly or something, that Geisel and Cerf were starting Beginner Books, they thought, hey. And they saw that Geisel was working with cartoons. He had hired Phil Eastman, he'd worked with in the movie business. They'd both been with Frank Capra in the Army, and Phil had been with Disney before that. And Geisel was working with Warren Key and other people. And my parents said, oh, he's like recruiting cartoonists to do these kids' books, and we're trying to do kind of cartoony kids' books. And so the whole connection with, they knew his work, they were familiar with it, and so that's what led them. And then they had just developed a relationship with their agent, Sterling Ward, at the same time. It was like a new thing, have an agent. And he said, well, what would you like me to try to do for you? He said, well, we'd like you to try to sell a book to Ted Geisel, who's just started this thing with Phyllis and Ben Cerf. And Ward said, well, Phyllis is an old friend of mine, so I'll go have lunch with her. And that was the origin of the deal. He like signed a deal with her at lunch, sight unseen.
So that's the origin of it. Did they come home one day and are like, guess who we're working with?
You know, I don't remember that phase of it. I don't remember an event of them announcing anything.
I'm sure.
I remember when they started working on the books. I remember them doing Freddy Bear Spanking very much. Right. I remember that very clearly. All the sketches for Freddy Bear Spanking, because I thought it was frightening.
I was going to say.
I thought it was a very frightening book. I remember that very vividly. I thought, they're actually going to publish the book about this, that pop, this father bear is going to hit his son with a giant tree and thing. And is that really what they're doing?
Nope.
I thought it was nuts. So I think that kind of overwhelmed the whole Seuss angle of it to me, the whole bizarreness of
right.
spanking. But then as it developed into the Honey Hunt, then, that makes sense. And then I began to focus more on Geisel's role. But I don't remember being surprised or interested in the fact that they were working with Dr. Seuss. That was just like, well, that's what they're doing.
And when did you know that you wanted to be an artist or an author? Like, how did that happen?
High school. I wanted to be an artist. Because I got interested in painting in high school. Before that, I'd been like a science kid.
Okay. You know,
telescopes and bug collecting and anemometers and all that and chemistry sets. But then high school, I had an art history class. Just, you know, part of art of high school. And the Renaissance and Botticelli. And I thought, wow, look at that. And I started to try to paint Michelangelo's things.
Yeah.
And then my dad saw me doing it. He says, oh, well, here, let's go to the museum. And so I began introduced to art. And so I went to art school to study painting. And I decided I didn't want to be a painter. I want to be an illustrator. So I studied some illustration. And I got a job at Random House. And I said, oh, I'll do this. So that was the evolution of that.
Now, before we go any further, I want to talk a little bit about these archives. The Berenstain Bear archives are located in the basement of Mike Berenstain's studio, and it's a nice, beautifully finished basement. It's very white. It's got a whole row of file cabinets and art cabinets, art drawers, like those big wooden flat drawers you pull out that make room for large pieces of art. And just imagine that over 50 years of history is stored in this basement. Every single Berenstain Bears book, product, VHS cover, promotional art, everything ever created for the Berenstain Bears is stored in this enormous archive. And not just the finished products either. If you open up a envelope for any specific book and pull out the papers inside, you will see preliminary sketches and ideas and crossouts and notes. And it's just somewhat overwhelming to a person like me or to someone like Brad or Jeremy to witness and handle these sheets that Stan and Jan themselves not only drew on and handled, but used to formulate the ideas and the concepts and the characters that we all love. It's awe-inspiring. And it's a good reminder that there were people behind all of this. For every picture of Papa Bear on a box of Berenstain Bears cookies, there was a hand drawing it. And it's not just every single book ever created. It's also books that never made it past the concept stage or never made it past the final concept stage, because there's a couple of unpublished things in these archives that never saw the light of day. I really wish I had just hours of footage to show you, because it's not just what we saw. It was the way in which we saw it. Mike was thrilled to show us this stuff, and it was humbling to be in the presence of someone who was there from the beginning and has not only a financial and a professional and an artistic stake in it, but an emotional stake as well. I honestly just cannot overemphasize how grateful I am to have been able to see this. So here's just a little taste of our time in the archives.
So let's see, these are books that are in various stages of development, the machines. Yeah.
Can we see? We've actually talked a little bit about big machines. Can we see, like, what?
Yeah, and this is a book again. It's an I can read book just on the subject matter that kids like. And we did this. I did this because people have liked other books along these lines. You know, like the ones about trucks.
And, right.
Here's proofs.
Ah, that's awesome.
Well, I love the cover. That's awesome. Even now as an adult, I still can get lost in this world.
I know.
It's a good place to be.
And sometimes, you know, I'm working on different stages of books and doing all the covers and writing them. This one, I did everything myself.
Okay.
So
I'm good at things like that, technical things, and I didn't think anybody else could do that. And also the research involved, that was such a mess that I didn't feel that it would be worth doing the research
and then
directing another artist to do all
this. Right.
That's see, and this, wonderful. This reminds me so much of Richard Scarry, you know, like
exactly.
Just all the different,
exactly,
like, I knew I was going to love this book.
This is a throwback to that kind of book. It's an evocation of the old world of kids' books where this is a standard kind of book.
Awesome.
It still is.
So how many additional artists do you have working?
Just two right now. We have at times had more, but we seem to be able to handle everything with me, Marianne, and my famous artist who lives in Georgia.
Huh?
I had the opportunity to talk to Marianne when we went back upstairs later on, and so I'm going to play a little bit of the conversation that she and I had at this point. If there's a little noise in the background, you'll hear maybe a little bit of yelling and exclaiming. That's Jeremy happily celebrating a thing that's occurring. I wasn't there, and it had to do with him discovering a book that he'd been looking for a long time. He wasn't aware that I was talking to Marianne because it was a little impromptu and off the cuff. So when you hear Jeremy yelling in the background, that's just Jeremy yelling in the background. So what's really cool, though, just to set this up, is that Marianne's art area is located right off of Mike's, and this is, she mentioned this, but none of this is digital. This is your traditional art table with pens and knives and paints and all kinds of art supplies just spread out. It looks like it could have been lifted right out of the 1950s because everything here is done by hand. And just, well, here's just a little bit of my talk with Marianne.
It's a lot of books.
Yeah. People are like, ask me, like, they're still making books.
Mm-hmm.
How many do they make? And I'm like,
a dozen
a year.
Yeah, no, people ask me, they're like, so how many episodes do you think your show's gonna run? I'm like, well, you do a book an episode.
So
forever.
It'll be a
I think
long time.
Just it's
yeah.
never gonna actually stop.
Yeah. Yeah. It might start to level out where you'll catch up.
Right, eventually. One episode a week.
I've been working with my crew like 4 years. starting to lose track of like which books I worked on and stuff.
Oh yeah, like, what are you working on right now?
This is a Lift the Flap book. So it's the Mike's doing the cover, the Get Ready for Bed.
Yeah.
So just laying out. These are more final sketches that Mike will have to like approve and stuff.
Mm-hmm. I'll bring you back Space Grizzlies.
Yep. Mike's been adding Space Grizzlies to a lot of stuff. I like that.
I love Space Grizzlies.
Me too. This was Bad Dream.
Yeah.
It was like one of my favorites when I was a kid.
That was one of my favorite episodes to do.
And I remember when I came here for my interview to meet Mike and talk about working for him. He was like, oh, what one do you want to see? And I was like, Bad Dream. And he showed me the artwork and I was like...
Well, I love it because I loved all the different Space Grizzlies. Like, they weren't bears. They were just...
Yeah,
these
weird.
Things.
His parents were so creative.
Yeah.
But yeah, and like the artwork is so vibrant.
Mm-hmm.
It like blew my mind.
Yeah.
Like it looks so different than in the books. And did you guys look at any of the original stuff in there?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, I figured, but. Yeah,
oh
it's
yes.
Incredible. But yeah, this is what I'm doing now. Like I start with more rough, sketchy stuff. Just my interpretation of Mike's manuscript, and then I talk to Mike about it. He tells me what I should change and what he's thinking. Sometimes it's nice and he doesn't want to change much, and sometimes he's like,
nope.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So you say you've been doing this for 4 years?
The first pretty much year was just me learning the technique.
That's amazing.
It's pretty cool. It's a
what are the hours like?
9 to 5.
9 to 5.
Yep. I feel
wow.
like it's the only 9 to 5 illustration gig around.
Yeah, it probably is the only
yeah.
9 to 5 illustration
so
gig around.
I'm trying to like appreciate it.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you like it? Just they just
Mike found me. I was working up in New York. I'm from Philadelphia. We went to the same college
yeah.
that him and his parents went to. And I was living and working up in New York, and I just got contacted by a former professor saying that Mike had been looking for suggestions of alumni for someone to help him with the books. And he looked at my online portfolio and like thought it I had a kind of a style that he could use.
Yeah.
Because I work traditionally. A lot of people now just work totally digitally.
Yeah.
But I still was doing traditional children's book stuff. So.
Peek behind the curtain.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty neat.
That's great. Thank you so much.
But I've started with a freelancer, not freelancer, an assistant, another assistant. Started with that when my dad died. Because we three of us have been doing everything.
Right.
Except for certain times when there was like a flood. Like
yeah.
back in the late 80s when we were doing everything with Golden Books and we had a lot of freelancers.
Right.
Had a lot of different things. But at that time, my dad and my mother and I were doing everything ourselves. And when he died, we were committed to doing whole lines of books and I needed
yeah.
other people. So I had an assistant. And then when things have gotten very intense, then I've gone back to one of the guy I had working for the computer is one of the freelancers who worked for us going way back. His books first back in the 90s.
Mm.
And so when times kind of get really tough, then I go back to him and he puts some of the work. And here's where we have everything stored. We've had to clean out a lot of stuff. This is one of the old Collier spreads.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Wow. These are miscellaneous stuff. These are, we've culled down the actual copies of books that we have stored. It used to be much. When it was at all in my parents' house, they had a huge basement, which was very disorganized.
Oh,
it was
wow.
a horrible mess, and they just had stuff stacked up. But we had tried to keep a few copies of everything that's been published, and that's what these boxes are, including even pre-Bear publications and old cartoon books and things. And what happens now is we're constantly getting, you know, authors' copies of things, and we give most of them away because we just don't have them to store them.
Right.
This is all not in these flat files, or
wow.
virtually all of the artwork from all the books. So if you have want to start, this is actually one thing that are, I might go with things that are out. These are some of the, haven't figured out how to store these best yet. These are all precepts from the full photographic separation days. These are
yeah.
hand separated.
Oh, wow.
Each one had like five, let's see, this is blue, red, flak, that's gray.
Yeah.
Yellow.
And I
would also be 100% black.
I never realized like that was the process, and that's something that they talk about in their autobiography.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Making that transition.
My mother did this herself. Oh. She was the queen of the gray washes.
Okay.
And my dad would be working on the drawings and the inking, and she would do this for years.
That's very, very so much work.
Incredibly difficult. So anytime you look at any book published, say before New Baby, before the 70s, there was a kind of transitional phase where they did kind of a hybrid version of that. But Nature Guide before that, 1970, before everything was done this way. Even things that look like full watercolors.
Right. Done that.
Wow. The other way. Oh, I don't know what this is. Oh, this is Storybook Bible. I guess it's just such a big, massive thing. I haven't filed it.
This was
done by... I did all the sketches for this. I wrote it and did all the sketches. And then I had my freelancer do the finishes because I was doing other things. But that's the Storybook Bible artwork.
Oh, wow. Goodness.
Yeah, my sketches are around somewhere. Anyway, he's a very good artist. Now, I have to redraw all his characters. In fact, I do that with all the drawings. I redraw everything on overlays. And also, I tend to redraw all the sketches, too. I mean, Marianne and this guy's name is John Kurtz. They'll send me a sketch version, and I will do overlays, and I'll redo it. Because although they can get it, frankly, to a certain point, I like it to be a little different. So I'll redo that. And then when they do the characters, I'll do overlays and redraw all the characters. Anyway, that's the Storybook Bible. See, Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
I thought it was really a riot.
That's the one that came out as a deluxe edition with the CD, right?
Yeah, uh-huh. I remember. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, yes. I like the snake. Anyway, it was fun. Anyway, that's here because it's such a massive thing. It doesn't fit in the drawers.
That is huge.
Yeah. Yeah, I got into a huge fight with Zonda. They wanted it on a certain schedule, and Harry couldn't deliver it in time.
You're like, it's the whole Bible.
Yeah, and I was going through terrible disruption because it was following my dad's death. And
I
was trying to make everything work, and we were having trouble with it. And first place, we couldn't, and this is where I started with my story upstairs, is that my parents' basement was an unfinished basement. It's not nicely finished.
Yeah.
It was just raw.
This is nice.
It was huge.
Yeah.
But it was just a raw basement with a lot of random shelves put in there, and they basically use it like a giant dumping pit for all their stuff and work, and my dad's old army clothes and my brother's old homework. It was all stuffed in piles, all the old animation cells. That's a horrible story, which I'm telling you if you want. It was just stuff. A lot of it was getting moldy.
You know what's so funny, but I don't mean to interrupt, but like the first time I ever wrote to your parents was back in probably about 1998 or so, and I sent them I had a couple questions for them, and then I sent them a list of like, oh, here are some books that like I need for my collection. And they wrote back and had a really nice letter for me, and they said, well, we don't have any of the books that you asked for, but here are a few that we like had on a pile. Like, then they sent me this box of like six or eight just like random books, and it was like I'm kind of imagining maybe they just went out in the basement and like, here, let's send them these.
They found something on top of the pile.
So that like totally makes sense.
So anyway, how that relates to the Christmas tree is that when Zondervan said, oh yeah, we'd like to adapt this, and okay, see, I love this book. I just wanted to get it back into print.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Frankly, how they adapted it was not very, I didn't think it made much sense, but I love the fact that it was back in print.
Sure.
You know, I love that book. I love the illustrations, and I love the old the original cartoon it was based on. And anybody who would do it in some form, I was willing to do, just because I loved it so much. But anyway, my parents had a few fat flat files like this up in their office. Not down in the basement, for like current stuff that they had worked on. It was, you know, not well organized, but it was there. And I went and found the file on the Christmas tree. And I just looked in it. I said, oh, there it is. So this artwork on the top of the file. So I said, you know, okay, yeah, we can publish this. I'll send you all the original artwork. So I go in the file and I take it out, and like the first two or three things are from the Christmas tree, and the rest of it's something else.
Oh no!
And it's like a 48-page book or something. It's like, where's the rest of it? And I looked at it. It's gone. I'd already signed a contract.
Yeah. Oh, no.
This thing. Where is it? It's gone. And I asked my mother, my mother, she said, oh, I don't know. It's not there. I don't know where it would be.
Oh, my gosh.
So I started just going through. I took all the stuff. I had like a stack of files like this in their office. And I just took everything out and went through it all.
Wow.
And finally, the bottom drawer, which was stuffed full of like old posters and old, it wasn't even original artwork, down crammed under all that stuff was the rest of, except for one spread.
Oh.
The most complicated spread I had to redo.
Oh.
I had to copy it from the original.
Whoa.
The final scene where the whole, the tree is all decorated with all the characters looking around it.
Yeah.
That was missing. I had to do that
one. Oh my gosh. Whoa.
But anyway, I found the rest of it in this cram. But anyway, so that was their organized stuff. You go down to the basement, you don't know where anything was. So we gave away most of their cartoon artwork to the Strong Museum, but then some of it I retained just out of nostalgia because I wanted to have some stolen by the family collection. But then we'd find other stuff sort of crammed behind shelves or stuck behind the furnace, like in old folders.
Oh.
So we've accumulated more of the cartoons. So anyway, it's cartoons.
At the, where I have my collection currently on display in Austin at that bookstore, we made sure to put a bunch of the early cartoons and cartoon books out in
medical,
in a prominent location. Actually, they're some of the few items you can actually like handle. And of course, everyone is first of all just shocked by the titles of some of those books. You know, Bedside Lover Boy and How to Teach Your Children About Sex. But then they actually open them up and they start reading them, and they're like,
they're
so funny, and they're still funny.
Yeah.
Like they're so timeless.
This is Stepwire. This is unpublished. This is what I think may have been the early predecessor of New Baby.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it's 8x8, and it clearly looks like some of the New Baby stuff, but it's simply a more Bear Country.
Wow.
Yard sale. They were going to have a yard sale and didn't.
Yeah. Well, this was a precursor to... here's a book that's never... It's actually a complete book that's never been published. This was a Cub Club book.
Oh my goodness.
That never got it, never made it. Oh, these are, I don't know what those are. These are like demos of how to draw the bears for somebody. These are, this is an interesting book. The Cub Club, they had planned a few more that were actually supposed to be published, and they were completed, but they never got published. And so this is one. I think this is the only one that we've never adapted and used in some other way. So these are the what we used to call mechanicals. These are like layouts to show where all the artwork and the text goes. This was a standard publishing, technique back then. Not superseded by all digital. It's all digital now. This is what my first kind of job was at Random House. I would do this stuff when I worked at Random House for a while. We used to do it all with, razor blades and X-Acto knives and rubber cement. Really.
It was the really big snow.
Yeah, really big snow. So that's the mechanical. So you see, it was all ready for shooting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all laid out. And then this is the artwork.
Oh, my goodness.
It's all completed.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, this was done. My dad did the sketches, and then the artwork was done by the artist who worked for a lot of Cub Club books for us, who came out of greeting card business.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was actually the best artist that ever worked for us. Beautiful artwork. It's backwards. That's a whole book. There's the cover.
Oh.
Oh, my gosh.
That's super cute.
That's so cute. Yeah.
And I think, I may... Now, it doesn't have Honey Bear in it, so I don't think I could just take this artwork and republish it. And also, HarperCollins, it doesn't have any... I don't see how we could make it into a Zondervan book. And Zondervan... And HarperCollins has never been interested in just adapting reprints. So I think it would have to be redone with modern artwork, even though this is very good about it. But it could be published just as a book, and it's a nice book.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, especially like this scene right here, this is a little bit more detailed than a lot of the Cub Club books were.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's a nice book.
Anyway.
Wow.
Oh, this is probably for the very first Christmas tree. My mom's first storyboards for Christmas tree. This was how to do a storyboard for the animators, like give them an idea of what they thought
Christmas
before the animators got home. This was like their model storyboard concept. Yeah. And this these pencil drawings were all my mom's work. She did. Wow. Anytime you see something in this kind of very graphic pencil, that was her work.
But I'm just gonna have you send me all your pictures.
I will. Yeah, I will share all of these.
I don't think I've ever even seen these before. They're stuck in the drawer.
Wow.
But they're very nice. And this one ended up being the end paper for the book.
Yeah, it sure was.
Look at that.
And
what is that one?
The Bebo.
Oh, the Bebo. Oh, the republishing of it.
Yeah. That's the
beautiful baboon.
This, I think, is the original black. Yeah, this is the original black line. Jammed in here like this or something. I did not do this. My fault.
I believe you.
And jammed in there too tight.
Hey, but
yeah, this is all brush. This is not the original brush.
So it's that one.
So this is...
Yeah, this is all the original black line from Bebo.
Oh, I see.
Wow.
Which then was printed in non-photo blue for them to do the separation.
Oh, right.
Yeah, okay.
So and that's a sketch version there.
Okay, so I got to take a picture.
So that's the original black line. And so all these early books were done this way. And they did it because it was expensive to do photographic separation. Because you had to hire photographers and engravers and, you know, union people to do it.
Yeah.
It was expensive. And it wasn't until, you know, things got to be automated that with computers and scanners and things that they were... Yeah, you can pull this out.
Okay.
These are... You know, this was a book done for Geisel, for Dr. Seuss.
Yep.
So he was such a stickler that they would go through dozens of different versions before they arrived at the final edition. So this was the original... One of the original sketch versions that they presented to Geisel. Many, many, many revisions over the years. An ancient Xerox from ancient times.
Oh, wow.
Great early Xerox. And this was some other version they started working on, the big blue baboon.
Oh, by B.B. Baboon.
Yeah.
I like that cover.
Yeah, I do too.
Why they call exhibits is like a long legal case. Big.
Oh.
See, they did one just without the big brown bear, with just a big blue baboon.
That's funny.
And I guess they figured they'd show him the Geisel and he'd pick which one they liked. Like, you know.
So because they were trying to get away from bears?
They were trying to get Geisel to approve. And he was very difficult. So they try anything. They just try all kinds of things. And so this is another version, but with the bull.
With the bull, right.
This is
getting more
amazing.
Like the actual book.
Yep.
Yeah.
But that's why there's all these elaborate versions, because they would present these to Geisel. And they back and forth endlessly for years.
Well, and I love the story about how he told them after the big honey hunt, no more bears, you gotta do something different. So they spent like all that time writing, making the penguin book, and then they take it to him and he says, I want more bears.
It's bear cells. It's bear cells.
The bike lesson was the second one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's when he called them the very same bears.
Right.
They offered them the name. And they didn't. That was not their idea.
No, they were surprised when they saw the cover. Yeah.
Because you think, what?
Right.
That's what they're called. What are the very same bears?
It's still even called.
Yeah.
And this is separations.
Yeah.
I'm just going to leave these things here because these things have to be reorganized anyway. Put them back in the little folders.
How are you feeling, Brad?
Oh, this is like...
So anyway, now what do you want to look at?
I want to see, like, spooky old tree.
This begins the hunt for the spooky old tree. Now, the archives are very well laid out and very well organized, but it's still in a relatively new system in the long run. So they actually Mike had to call down Eleanor at one point to help find the spooky old tree because they weren't entirely sure where it was located in the archives. There was a little bit of digging, a little bit of searching. By the time we found it, it was... Well, the beginning of a revelation, because not only do these envelopes contain all the artwork that was submitted for publication, it contains, of course, all the notes and all the preliminary sketches and all the preliminary ideas. And so as Brad and Mike and I went through these pages, Mike discovered something about the origins of the spooky old tree, the initial concepts that he had never known before. Unfortunately for Jeremy, he was down in another part of the archives, and so he missed this point. So I was just happy to be there and to be able to capture this moment when Mike discovered that the spooky old tree wasn't always the spooky old tree.
With all kinds of different crazy things going on.
Yeah! That's nuts!
That's super cool.
Bats. There were lots of bats in the first version. Yeah, just different ideas. And it wasn't even a spooky old tree. It was a mysterious cave at first.
Oh my goodness.
I didn't even know that. Yeah, this is. I don't think this was a version that they showed anybody.
Yeah,
maybe it was. It might. I don't know.
like roughing some ideas.
Tell me about missing something awesome.
Oh, maybe the one there wasn't even a spooky old tree in the spooky old tree.
Really?
It started out as a mysterious cave.
Which I didn't even know. Where is
Wow.
Yeah, mysterious cave.
Oh my god.
An early version.
Do they dare?
Do they dare?
It's an early version of it. It's a cave instead of a tree. And they have a lot more bats.
A room full of bats. Lots of
bats. All with the shivers.
Yeah, I don't, I've never seen these before.
Looking in the room. Dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these pencil drawings are all my mom.
Okay.
And this would have been the original sketch version of the original cover.
And you know these are your mom's because you just recognize her style, or she always did the written sketches?
She always did anything that's in pencil. That's what she did.
Okay.
My dad would do sketches in pen.
Okay.
And then she would take his rough sketches at this stage of their career. I mean, they went through a lot of different iterations of this stuff. But at this stage of things, he would do rough sketches in pen, pencil and pen. Mm-hmm. It'd be very, they would just be this layout, but it would be a kind of rough drawing with pen. And then she would take it and develop it into this finished presentation kind of sketch version in pencil. And then when they went to do the finishes, she would trace it onto the illustration board.
Okay.
And I'm talking about when not in this, the back when they did the full separation, it was different. But it, by this time, when they're doing, this is the finished artwork, say, when they're doing this full color, everything's on one page artwork, she would trace it in pencil onto the illustration board. Then my dad would do the inking and the color at that stage, and then she'd be going on to doing more pencils, and so they had it really worked out that she did all the sort of the fine development work. He would do the rough work, she'd do the middle period developed work, and then he would do the finished work. And so that way they were able to work on things in stages and work on different books at the same time, because they were working at different chronological stages of the book. Now later on she would did the color too, but at this stage they had it divided up that way. But you can see the incredibly elaborate way as these were developed, these early books.
Well, and it's so interesting learning about, you know, how it kind of had to be that way to satisfy Ted, but also they had more time.
Right. And that also was economic, because back then, this was before the great wave of media tie-in publishing. This is like in late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. And if you think about, when did Little Mermaid come out, the first big new age?
89. Yeah. Yep.
Before that, media tie-in children's publishing was not a very big thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's when it all started, after the Eisner-Katzenberg era of Disney.
Yep.
So before that, they could make a lot of money from publishing a few very select books a year.
Right.
It was an era of, and the publishers could, and the authors could. So there wasn't the great economic drive to do lines of books. You would do six books a year. You do one book a season. You do two books a year. And you'd sell. They'd sell tons of them. And they'd sell them through many forms of distribution. They'd sell them through the bookstores, which were this vast network of quality bookstores all over the country. And they'd all sell this book. And then you'd sell them somewhat to the mass market. And you'd sell them through book clubs. Book clubs was a huge thing. These books sold far more and made vast amount of money through the Growler Book Club program, the monthly continuity program, than they ever did from selling in stores.
And so, they still are.
So, yeah. Well, no, they still sold, but they're a minor thing now, relatively speaking.
But like, you still can still, exist. Like, they still are, yes. Like, I'm still
a
member of one.
Yeah, but back then, in this era, the big moneymaker was the book clubs.
Yeah.
They were like, they 70-80% of the income royalties from the book clubs as opposed to store sales.
Mm. How did the Cub Club do financially for the series? Was that a big seller? Or?
Yeah, it sold quite well.
Because I'm kind of amazed, now those books are still very readily available. You know, you go on eBay.
No, they sold a lot of it. It went through a form with Western. Golden Books sold them directly in their book club. But then Golden Books was going through a lot of problems, and had been for years, and it resulted ultimately in them being bought by Random House, part of Bertelsmann. But at that time, they still were trying to be like a full publisher, doing all kinds of publishing and doing their own book club. So they sold a lot of them, but they were not making, and we did okay from it, but they weren't that division was becoming unprofitable for Western. So they sold off the clubs to Reader's Digest.
Right.
Which, of course, was much more successful and dominant in book clubs. But just as they acquired the rights to the series and launched them and did fine with them, they began to get into trouble. Mm. Oh. And the Random Reader's Digest eventually went under, you know, as it going. And that was, they acquired the rights to the series just as that was beginning to kind of go down. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't earn out their guarantee in the contract, so the rights all reverted to us. And so we had all rights to the books. And that's when we began to adapt them to other purposes. Repurpose them.
Wow. Anyone who thinks the publishing world is straightforward and complicated.
We had all these great ideas.
There's been a lot of things go on in the publishing business, and the business changes, and it goes through different kinds of disturbances and disruptions, and that affects the whole chain of everybody doing it.
Well, I think it's part of what people think, is they think like the Berenstain Bears or a Little Critter, any of these characters who've been around for decades. People think, oh, they've been around for decades and they'll just be around. Like, they've been around because they're around. And you don't know all the...
No, they eventually, if you don't make it stay around, they go away. They become just something that people, whatever happened to so-and-so.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to Raggedy Ann Andy.
Sure.
What's the era of? They were like the dominant children's book series in the 20s.
Right.
And people still, oh yeah, I know what those are.
There's one terrifying motion picture made in the 1970s, early 80s.
And yeah.
So in the early 2000s, when was it, Brad? When the Berenstain, you guys put a bibliography on your website and listed something.
Yeah. It was badly done.
Oh, okay.
It's not very good.
Well,
didn't do it. I had somebody do it for me, and it was kind of messed up.
Okay. Well, we had a question about, obviously, there were some books that were missing, which we've filled in all those cracks. But there's one book that's on it that we're so mystified by. It's called The ABC Tablet. And what we've been able to discover...
No, that doesn't ring a bell.
Right. Yeah. Learn is that it probably was just like...
a product. It wasn't a book.
Correct. But neither one of us have ever seen it. And we're like, does it exist? Like, it must. I mean, if it ended up on the bibliography, like, there must be at least records of it.
There was, it must have been in some...
I said by Plymouth Incorporated published it.
Plymouth Paper. And they also made...
That's got me baffled. Yeah.
Which means it's probably somewhere.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I never heard of Plymouth. I never heard of ABC Tablets.
Right. I don't know anything.
Maybe we can scratch it off our list.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what it is. I mean, it doesn't exist.
There was that fun book.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we did find that. And it's so funny that I happened to come across it right after you.
That's one of my favorite stories.
I was pulling out some book to look for something, and there it was.
Wow.
That sounds like I made it up, but I didn't.
That's how it happens, though, you know? Like, that's so amazing.
And finally, one of the funnier, stranger, weirder little artifacts in the basement was a giant full-size drawing of Mama and Papa Bear with their faces cut out for Stan and Jan to put their faces through for a article that was written about them. And it's this just wonderful poster size image of Mama and Papa. And here's Mike describing not only why they made it, but who the photographer was who took the picture.
Oh, here's something you'll like. I found this going through my mother's basement.
Oh, my goodness. Oh my goodness. Hold on, I gotta get a picture of this.
This was created for an article in People magazine.
Wow.
Where they wanted some big visual, so they said, how about you make a big picture of Mom and Papa, and Stan and Jan, you put your heads through it, and we'll take a picture of People magazine.
And it ended up on the cover of that biography.
On a Sunny Dirt Road?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
No, it's the one of those...
It was done for a kid's book series of biographies.
Correct.
I have it. Is it the purple?
And bluish colored one. Yeah, it's black and white, but it's on the cover of...
I'll tell you something that's a wonderful piece of publishing trivia and bizarre. The photographer who did this series for People magazine, who did the photography, are you familiar with the famous, maybe your generation or not, there's a famous picture from the Vietnam War of a guy executing a guy with a pistol?
Oh, yeah.
That photographer did the pictures for my parents. Same guy.
He was a controversial figure.
Yeah, he won a Pulitzer for that.
Yeah.
But he was a professional photographer. Yeah, he worked for all kinds of magazines, and he was working for People magazine.
It's such a connection.
Thank you so much for letting us into your world.
That's a bizarre piece of trivia.
It's not something you put on the back of a book.
And that marks the end of this little segment of our visit with Mike. I hope you enjoyed hearing some more of our conversation and our exploration and a bunch of just like grown men oohing and aahing over a bunch of children's book drawings. But I cannot overemphasize how cool this trip was. I could talk about it forever. And there was just so much that is unshareable because of how just immediate and emotional it was, and you kind of had to be there. But I really want to share this with everyone. This was such an experience. Again, thank you, Brad and Jeremy, for making it possible. But this isn't the end. There's going to be some more little bits and bobs coming up, especially stuff from the Strong Archives, which was just a whole other experience altogether. Just a reminder that I talk about the Berenstain Bears a lot. I talk about the goofiness of the world, the wonderfulness of the world, the strange complexity of the world. But to keep in mind that it was a product of people. It still is the product of actual real people, writers and illustrators, and a family who has kept this world within the family for over half of a century. And I want to thank Mike Berenstain so much, again, for letting us into his home, his studio, to see the history of this wonderful, wonderful world. It was amazing. So thank you, everybody, for listening to part three of our talk with Mike, and I hope you tune in for more Berenstain Bears. Goodness, we've got more books coming up. Again, go to my Patreon page, patreon.com/deepinbearcountry, if you want to become a member of this wonderful Berenstain Bears community. You'll get a few little opportunities to do some stuff if you give a little bit of dough to me, I guess. That was weird. I don't know why I said it like that. Otherwise, just go to deepinbearcountry's various internet presences of berensteinbearcast.wordpress.com, Twitter at bstainbearcast. You can write to me on Google at berensteinbearcast@gmail.com. Please rate and review the show on iTunes if and you like it. You can always boost our signal a little bit. If you have Twitter and you want, you can tweet about us if you want to do a hashtag Potter and Family or anything like that just to boost our signal a little bit. We'd really appreciate it. Always looking for more people to welcome into the fold and find out about this bizarre podcast I've been doing for well over 2 years now. Isn't that strange? I've never devoted this much time and energy to anything in my entire life, studies or anything. So that's weird. And pat myself on the back. I just sort of keep doing it, don't I? Just kind of keep doing it. Also, don't forget that I have two more podcasts, in case you didn't know. I have a podcast I do with Mr. John McCoy called Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast where we discuss Beverly Cleary. And I also do a podcast with my 16-year-old, Ollie, called It's Del Toro Time, where we discuss the movies of Guillermo del Toro, the movies of colleagues of Guillermo del Toro, and the movies that influenced Guillermo del Toro. Right now, we just did, I think, Freaks by Todd Browning just came out. So we're working chronologically through that. So if you like movies, you like old movies, you like scary movies or mysterious movies or weird movies, listen to It's Del Toro Time. It's kind of like this, only with another person and talking about movies, not Berenstain Bears. It's nothing like this, except my voice is the same, kind of, because I'm talking to my kid, so I have a different tone of voice, a little more authoritative, a little more know-it-all, a little more exasperating dad. So that's kind of that. Okay, well, otherwise, I don't have anything else to say. I'm just excited that you're here and you're still listening. So thank you, everybody, for your dedication, your time, and your listenership. And I will see all of you next week deep in Bear Country.